Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, where we discuss the latest DevOps news, AWS announcements, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's June 18th, 2025. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. If you haven't heard about Cloud Posse, well, Cloud Posse sells AWS reference architectures that get you production ready in 2 weeks. So if you're curious to learn more, go to cloudposse.com. So, how can you maximize today's session? First off, our format is informal. You can engage as much as you'd like, ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules like Atmos, this is a great place to ask. For those on the recording, we host these calls live, so don't miss out. You can join us by registering at cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's sessions valuable, please share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse where you'll find that recording. So with that said, let's discuss the current events. All right, first one, not news per se. I think these things have been going around so much. And CEOs from Fiverr and forget the other one. Brought this up recently. Also, we talked about last week that some Amazon workers are saying, engineers specifically, are saying that their job is starting to feel a lot more mundane, kind of like working on an assembly line. And well, we all know what Amazon did to their warehouses. They automated them fully with robots, shrinking that workforce. Well, Amazon's CEO now is saying the same thing. So this is, well, I don't want to go through this here, but yeah. And he's basically in a memo saying, expect more of this to come at Amazon. And I think we're seeing this across the board. A lot of companies, they are downsizing as a result of some of the things that, vibe coding and agentic programming are able to do. Any thoughts or comments on this one? Just delete you. There we go. That wasn't enough. I still can't scroll. Oh well. Next point. Let's see here. One second. I gotta log in again. I hasn't done that for a while. Sharing my screen again. All right. Next one was a project called Canine. It is another, kind of self-hosted Heroku alternative. I think the key thing is that it runs on Kubernetes. So wherever you can get a Kubernetes cluster, you can leverage Canine. I thought it was a hilarious play on words. We all know K8S is Kubernetes abbreviated, with the 8 being the number of characters in between the K and the S in Kubernetes. There's a popular dashboard called K9. K9 is a console-based app. And well, we all know a K9 is also a dog, I guess. Is it the Greek word for dog? Anyway, so K9, play on words on K8, is that. They talk about how you can also even run it on Hetzner Cloud. So if you are doing your own little projects or labs, maybe that's a cool alternative. It's amazing that the markup could go from, obviously, Heroku does a lot more than this, and their managed databases and other integrations. But to go from $4 up to $250 for the same amount of memory and CPU, there's a lot of markup in that. Next one was, oh, this was hilarious. I'll share this in the chat. We won't listen to the whole thing here in on the call. Anyone who hasn't watched Silicon Valley that is in tech, do yourself a service and get a good laugh. I found the show hilarious. The show is like, I don't know, almost 10 years old now, or I don't know, 6 years old. But in this episode, it talks about Guilfoyle doing the equivalent of agentic programming. And this is before this was even on my radar. I admit I wasn't the latest to the game, but I was surprised that this was already a thing at the time they scripted, wrote, and directed this episode of Silicon Valley. In this episode, he has it do some refactoring to remove bugs. And what is the best way to remove bugs? You just delete code. So the AI agent just deleted everything, and that fixed the bugs. And then some other things. Any comments on Silicon Valley or that episode? This was just circulating this week on LinkedIn because it's very timely based on everything going on. All right. Another one here I thought was really interesting. I thought it was a very clever bypass to de-anonymize traffic. And I didn't know, maybe most people probably didn't know this was happening, but they got caught. This sounds a little bit like Facebook's Zoom moment. Do you guys remember when Zoom had basically a backdoor on every system where it was installed, an API endpoint listening on localhost that they could use to reinstall Zoom, bypassing all the security controls on the operating system and so forth? It was a big thing, during peak COVID when Zoom was like this in popularity as everyone was moving home. Well, this is kind of like that. So, as you know, with tracking, you know how browsers are making it much harder to get cookies, for example, to pass between sessions for privacy concerns, and this is mandated by things like GDPR. Well, Facebook came up with a way of de-anonymizing your browser sessions, even if you are in incognito mode on the browser, and they know you're going to those porn sites. Basically, they can hit a service listening on localhost that is the Facebook app. So let's say on your mobile phone. And that will provide a session ID or an identifier, basically, that then they populate all subsequent requests that are sent by that cookie or that pixel running inside of the incognito window. And since localhost is trusted by default, and it's able to get past all of that. So big fines are coming to Facebook for that. Anyone else know more about this or can add more color? Also makes me think of some of the, shady things that Uber was doing back in the day, identifying, what were they? I don't know, they basically gray listed people who were known to be affiliated with government, certain government agencies that were after them. If you haven't seen the documentary on Google, or not, it's a reenactment kind of what happened with Google, Uber rather. It's a really interesting one. I forget what it's called.
By the end of this blog, didn't they also mention that Facebook just removed it outright as soon as they had published this blog, which also seems pretty suspicious.
Well, you might as well stop the fines as soon as
Yeah.
you Yeah, and apparently the fines are up somewhere around like up to 10% of their global annual revenue. So serious cash. All right. I'm just surprised this stuff still goes on. I mean, when you're that big under such a lens, it's just a matter of time. So it's either got to be a calculated move where it was still worth that $32 billion liability, Not that they're going to pay that full amount and the appeals and everything else, but yeah.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. All
It's pretty
right.
unbelievable what companies think they can get away with. It's like, seriously, guys?
Yeah.
How is this not going to be discovered at some point, you know?
Yeah. What was that? I heard an interesting way of thinking about millions and billions, and I don't remember the exact units of scale, but it was something like 1 million seconds is 11 days or something, but 1 billion seconds is 27 years. And that's so then you can see just then 32 billion, just how big that number is. Next announcement. So assuming you weren't under a rock last week, every service you were using was displaying signs of problems or instability. Especially if anything relied on Cloudflare or what Cloudflare depended on, which was Google. And the combination, like if you cast a web of what depends on Cloudflare and what depends on Google, that is kind of like, 80% of the internet, maybe. I don't know, I'm exaggerating there. But it was a pretty significant outage. Most AI coding systems, including Cursor, and I use something called Willow Voice, which is pretty awesome. That was having problems, probably because that was using Google. So yeah, this was painful. And what I found most interesting about this, and it just shows how little I knew about the current state of Cloudflare and its architecture. I always thought of Cloudflare as kind of their own infrastructure as a service. I didn't think that they were leaning on Google or Amazon or other cloud providers. I always, I thought they racked and stacked all their own hardware, all their own services, and built that. They have a lot of innovation also in web serving and things like that. So the fact that Cloudflare was using Google's KV storage, and that was integral to like every service, they have a list here that was affected. Workers KV, Access, Gateway, Warp, Dashboard, Challenges and Turnstile, Browser, Isolation, Images, Stream, Real-Time Workers. I mean, like, I can keep going here. Everything went down because Google went down. And it's like too big to fail at this point, right? Any other thoughts on this commentary?
I think you're spot on. It was super disheartening to read because that's exactly what they talk about in this whole report. They do everything themselves from scratch. They dog food their own services. And they revealed, I think, somewhere in there, this was apparently just a few weeks. This was on their radar. They knew relying on Google was a bad idea. This was a known coverage. They were hoping to get it migrated within a week or so. But it just so happens that's the week.
That hurts.
It's so sad to read because they did everything right. That's the goal. You build it all yourself from scratch and still.
No good deed goes unpunished. Well, sunshine stories, then I guess that accelerated that move, presumably.
And I think the Google's report came out a few days after this one, so they couldn't even point to it. They had nothing to go off of. It was just they kept mentioning a third-party vendor, which was doing a lot of heavy lifting, that third-party vendor.
But it was so obvious. If you went to the status pages that day of every site that was affected, then this came up very quickly. And you go to the Google status page, and it was just like black swan. Everything was down. Every service was affected. I didn't actually. I forgot to look up what the incident report was on Google Cloud's outage. Do you know what that was about, Rishabh?
I did, yeah. Apparently, it was very similar to the CrowdStrike. I see Paul mentioned, oh, sorry, Muhammad mentioned in the chat. It was to do with a feature flag that they didn't add. So they created a new feature, didn't feature flag it, and it was a policy quota manager thing. And if you pass in an empty policy, that then negates it altogether. And because they have copy and duplicate across the globally, that just shuts down IAM for everyone immediately. Terrible. And yeah, identical to CrowdStrike, apparently.
Well, I'm trying to recall now. The CrowdStrike one, that one was especially bad now. That was the thing that was it, but was the CrowdStrike one feature flag related? What was so interesting about the CrowdStrike one that I recall was that they could publish these security packs, if you will. I forget what they were called. And there was one that just had a syntax error or something, and that took down every CrowdStrike instance. And it's like, how did CI not catch this, right?
That was exactly it. That's exactly it. So they had this feature they added, and you could pass an empty and it would break, and they never tested that empty edge case. Never was tested in QA, never tested in staging. So it just immediately went live when they pushed it. And of course, they did the classic in like paragraph two or three of the report. They mentioned our status dashboard didn't report this in the first 30 minutes because that also relies on GCP infra. So sorry about that.
Oh, that's so interesting. It'll be interesting when clouds kind of have a cloud exchange where Google hosts Amazon status page, Amazon hosts Google status page.
That's exactly it.
Right. Thanks for filling me in there. So Canico was a popular project for a little while. Look, as 15,000 stars. This was when there was really no way to build rootless containers, and building containers in Kubernetes, or Docker and Docker was a real pain in the butt. Canico was one of the first solutions aimed to solve that. Apparently, it's not officially a Google project, but hosted by Google. Well, this has officially been archived. It is no more. And this is just because building rootless containers and building containers overall is so much easier now. So probably no one here using it anymore. Another small thing that caught my attention in the OpenTofu community was a language server for OpenTofu specifically. This is necessary now as the languages diverge in functionality and syntax or capabilities. So it's an early project. It's only at version 0.0.3, which means everything is subject to change at any time. And I'm not sure, I haven't been able to test it myself yet. So just be aware that that is on its way, and this will become more and more problematic using the HashiCorp BSL version. I don't know that their language server is BSL, but it is for BSL HCL, so to say, or BSL type implementation of HCL. Couple small announcements out of AWS this week. Obviously, they release like 25 announcements a week. Most of them are like, "Hey, this thing is in this new region." But this caught my attention a little bit. So with ECR, with what is it? AWS Inspector, you can identify images that have vulnerabilities. But you might have 10,000 images. What does it matter if 999,000 of them are not actually deployed and running anywhere? Obviously, you should do something about that. But the bigger thing is like what's actually running, and that's what you need to be concerned about. They have now surfaced this in two services. So AMI, sorry, Docker images, container images. Running specifically on Kubernetes and ECS are now surfaced as a last use date. So you can kind of get a rough idea or estimate where those images are used. Now they just need to update that with the other 18 places or wherever you can run Docker images in AWS, and it'll be a solved problem. I remember Vlad Lunosky. Was it 17 ways to run Docker in AWS? Yeah. This is out of date now, from 21, but he had a good post about the 17 different ways you can run containers on AWS. So pick one.
Good start.
Back to announcements. And AWS announced seven more compliance frameworks. FedRAMP R4 standing out, updated version of CIS, so CIS 8, updated version of PCI DSS. And these are under the, so they say control tower, but really all that is conformance packs. So if you're using Terraform and Cloud Posse has some modules to deploy the AWS config rules from conformance packs, these are some of the new ones there. Somebody, yeah, Mohammed?
Yeah, maybe not the right time to ask the question, but I want to know if someone is using Control Tower versus like vanilla Terraform or other stuff. So, are you
Yeah.
guys still using it at Cloud Posse at least?
We're still using pure Terraform, managing AWS organizations, OU, service control policies, all that jazz with pure Terraform. The way things are moving, Amazon investing everything in Control Tower. I mean, I think it's something we would like to support. We have recently kicked the tires again on it a little bit. There's an interesting paradigm here, and it depends on what you're optimizing for. And the more we work with enterprise, we see some patterns evolve. So, first of all, Control Tower, if you're not familiar with it, is Amazon's service to manage AWS organizations and accounts, and put guardrails through things called SCPs, and monitor for compliance using things like AWS Config and Security Hub and Audit Manager and so forth. A lot of this can be managed out of the box with Control Tower, and it feels pretty nice, feels pretty magical, honestly. You just set it up and it works. And I think that it has its time and place for certain organizations at a certain point. And that's, I guess you could say, at either end of the spectrum, maybe. We're thinking about the standard bell curve. So on the one side, you're far, far to the left, really small, two, three person company. You're just going to launch a few services in AWS. You at least want to have standard SDLC and CloudTrails and SSO set up, and you're not really too concerned about IaC at this stage. And you can just set up Control Tower in an hour, and you're on your way. Then you have on the other side of the spectrum your massive enterprise. And here you have a specific team that operates 9 to 5, and they only process ServiceNow requests. That's all they do. And to create accounts or to get anything done, you file a ServiceNow request. And we're talking like your really large financial institutions and things like that. And for them, there's really no value in infrastructure as code because the people doing it are going to do ClickOps, and they have their own processes for how workstations are secured and how people access Control Tower and how they do that. And if they did infrastructure as code, that's a whole nother Pandora's box of things they got to solve for under that constraint. And then you got the people in the middle here. And that's your mid-sized companies, your tech companies, your companies that are, comfortable with IAC, understand it. You're a smaller team, you want to do more with less. Code is what enables that. It's what allows you to codify your systems, your processes, and fix it and reinvent it. So I feel like personally, Cloud Control Tower is doing a disservice to that midsection. And that's because there is very poor API support for Control Tower. They have slowly been releasing some API endpoints, and there is slowly some functionality coming out, therefore, in Terraform to control Control Tower. Their solution to this is this thing called account factories for Terraform, which is one of these really obtuse Goldberg apparatuses. That chains together a lot of like probably 15 or more different AWS services and Lambdas and event bridges, and cloud formations that trigger other cloud formations and do all of these things. And then there is no preview of what's going to change before you make those changes. It's just like, trust us. Trust me, I don't make mistakes. And that's account factories for Terraform. So now you can provision account factories for Terraform with Terraform. And that's what makes a lot of these things confusing. So there's account factories, and account factories has nothing to do with Terraform. And then there's account factories for Terraform, which is a way to use account factories with Terraform. And then there's a Terraform module or set of modules that provision account factories for Terraform with Terraform. But that's not how you get really use account factories with Terraform, if you get my drift. Like, you're not really using Terraform. So I really like our solution in the end for managing accounts with Terraform, organizational units with Terraform, and the whole thing with Terraform. But everyone who thinks that like crossplane is the end all be all has not seen anything below Kubernetes. And there's a lot of infrastructure that sits below a Kubernetes cluster, and you're not using crossplane for that. And that's what we're solving with Terraform and like in our reference architecture and all of that. So that is to say, Control Tower does a lot because you have to do a lot of work in Terraform to get parity with that. But you get that parity when you use our modules. All right, Mohammed, that was a mouthful. Questions?
Thank you so much. I think much appreciated for the explanation. And I totally agree with you, still on the mid of the curve for myself and clients. So stick with the pure Terraform for now, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. But so just playing devil's advocate here for a moment. One of the things that Control Tower does really nicely out of the box is set up your security hub, your AWS config, architecture, enable the conformance packs and the guardrails and all that. And historically, doing that with Terraform has been really painful. I know that because we have the implementation of it. I know that there's been some improvements to the Terraform providers that make that easier. But depending on when you started doing this, if you try to implement AWS Config and Security Hub and Audit Manager in earlier versions of AWS's APIs, that was not good. And then there's kind of like, is it worth, in the end, is it worth being this, what's the word I'm looking for? To be so disciplined on infrastructure as code that it ultimately works against you. Like, you could get this thing done in a few clicks over here, what you could also do in infrastructure as code, but it's going to be this much, code and it work to get it out. There is a balance there, but I think if you're familiar with how those technologies work, then I think the IAC solution is still the way to go because that gives you the granular control over them. All right, that was that. Another note was just something Michael shared with me. Thanks, Mike. AWS now is enforcing MFA for all root users across all account types. So this used to be an SCP. You always wanted to deploy and provision. Well, now you don't even need to do that because this is just the hard requirement. And let's face it, I mean, MFA radically escalates the complexity to compromise a root account. Doesn't mean it can't happen, but it makes it a lot harder, depending on your choice on MFA. And the last announcement. So I don't know about you guys, but I can't keep up with all the agentic systems and ways to program and AI, things that open PRs on your behalf. I am using Cursor regularly, and that's been amazing. I know one of the members on our team is using Windsurf and really happy with it. I haven't had the chance to try out Claude Code, which is kind of like a terminal-based approach to it. And I hadn't even bothered to look at OpenAI Codex until a developer who's worked with us recommended I check it out. So I was pretty excited about that. I looked at it. So this is the announcement. This was back in May. So if you're on top of all this stuff, you've already seen this, and this is old news, but it was news to me, and so that might be news to others. So that's interesting. There is a CLI. I haven't explored that part. I guess that's part is more akin to what you can do therefore with Claude Code maybe. But if you have OpenAI as a let's see here, let me switch to, I had it open here. Yeah, here. I guess I wasn't logged in here. One second, let me just log in here. All right. So it's the similar it at first, the reason why I wasn't so excited about it is that I'm skeptical, as you know, anyone should be trying out something like this, and that skepticism remains. But what I'm feeling is like there's different tools for different jobs and different types of tasks. And our job right now is to get good at the ones that do the right tasks the right way and save us time and effort. So what I really love about Cursor, for example, in that experience, as I've gotten used to it, is the iterative process of developing rapid feedback loops, especially on front ends and things like that. But I can totally see that there's certain kinds of maintenance tasks, especially if your code base has a sufficient amount of tests that can be largely automated with a sufficient prompt and skill at prompting that, and maybe a good agents.md file. So one of the things that I did this morning in playing around with it was ask it to fix all the spelling mistakes. This is obviously a very low bar to achieve, and I think it did a really good job on it. So it scanned through the entire code base, doing research, looking through every file, and found a lot of typos that have been in this code base for a long time. So this is a great, quick, easy win that you can do if you're already paying for ChatGPT, at least as a team, which is what we have. This seems to come at no extra cost. I don't know yet what the limits are. I haven't hit them, but pointing it at your internal documentation repo is a great first quick win, right? Even if it does nothing else for you, if it can fix all your typos, I call that a win, and you can throw it away and say AI sucks after that. But I liked it. So about this, so if you go into one of these, you can see the changes that it proposes. You can do a code review in the tool here, and then when you're ready for it to open the pull request, you just create the button, click pull request, and if you are iterating on this through here, you can then update it. Now, bear in mind, iterating here is not at all like the chat-based experience you might have had in ChatGPT. It's literally launching like a code container, and like the feedback loop is minutes, not seconds. So this is what I mean, like different tools for different jobs. So what is interesting about this is like with something like Cursor, I am not working on fixing three or four different things at the same time. I can't keep the chat straight and the same code base is checked out, and I'm not working in four different checkouts and yada, yada, yada. But in this case, this is like four different checkouts, four different, you know, or like in this case, what is it? I don't know, seven different branches. And I've opened the three pull requests as a result of this work. You get to choose when those pull requests are open. So you know, this looked good enough to me that I opened the pull request, and then our tests run. And if our tests pass, great. Let's merge it, ship it, move on. Curious, anybody been playing around with this? If so, what are the kinds of things you had quick wins with? Where did it not work out for you?
Always nervous if it's a good use case, but some of our UI developers have been using it to create translations of their some of their front-end websites. And Of course, that's questionable on the quality of the translation. We don't really know that until we put it in front of an expert. But it's pretty impressive just seeing it kind of figure out that, okay, this is the templating language, this is the internationalization, and it just slaps in whatever the top five most common languages are. Ridiculously impressive seeing it do its thing.
That is really cool. That's a great idea. There was that link, what was it? Lingua.dev or something. I forget. We had talked about it in office hours with Tom.
You did. Yeah.
Yeah, that did this behind the scenes, but I do like a little bit less magic, and that's why I like what you're suggesting is that when you have the language files there in the code base and you are committing those and working with it, you can iterate towards a stable, perfect translation. And my experience is like, so I speak Swedish, so the translations there are just amazing. And my wife is Chinese, and she's always blown away by how natural and native those translations are. And then what's crazy is when you can just transcend languages and have these conversations. So I would believe a lot in the OpenAI ability to do, create those translations.
It's also a little bit nerve-wracking giving up your GitHub repo permissions to something like this. I know you're in control of the actual final commits and all that, but there's always that feeling of, wait, are they just hoovering up my data? And then GitHub does the same, I'm sure, behind the scenes, so does it matter? Maybe, probably all that much.
But it's kind of like, out of sight, out of mind.
Right.
So having to do it makes you more concerned about it, even though that is the case. Yeah. I could imagine that, especially if one's, doing some rocket science in a private repo somewhere, where, there's something really innovative there. Yeah, nothing in our domain that I'm worried about. Is in a private repo. So.
For what it's worth, I can't find a link. It was, I think, on LinkedIn or somewhere, the CTO of OpenAI. They recently launched this new thing called connectors. It's just integrations with other things like Google Drive, Gmail. So you can bring your enterprise data directly into ChatGPT. Should probably be one of the announcements, but one of the neat things about that is GitHub is on that list. So now you can bring in your GitHub repos, integrate that into ChatGPT, and ask it questions directly.
I was trying to do that the other day, and I saw that the only connector that I had access to was the Google Drive one, and then I
Ah.
saw that they're rolling it out slowly. So, did you have access to the other connectors?
That's right. We have I think Gmail, Google Calendar, Drive, and GitHub. There was a caveat with the GitHub one. That's the one I really cared about. It always has to be in deep research mode, i.e., you're kind of burning through your
I
tokens.
saw that. Yeah.
But at least you can do that now, and given you have an enterprise contract with them, there is less of a worry about leaking data.
Yeah, and they did increase the limits on deep research credits. Now I think you can get 50 or so a month. It was only 10 before for teams, which was annoying because professionals could get 200 searches, and even that's not enough. So, very interesting. Anybody know what the limits are on the Codex thing? No. All right, that's all the announcements I had. Let's see what is in the chat. Multi-agent collaboration.
So this was just on the same vein of me finding about the OpenAI Codex. I found it about Claude Code, and has the MCP support. And what blew my mind, and you can open it up, it's just a link to a Reddit post, but this guy explains his workflow of how he does his thing. And the way he has it set up is he has these MCPs. They're all Claude models, so it's nothing third party, but he gives one of those MCPs the task of finding out and identifying an issue and talking about it. Another model is responsible for developing code for it, and the third one is the QA. And they just talk with each other, they interact with each other until the QA one has a successful resolution. It's ridiculous seeing someone do this thing, and
Does
I'm really keen to get started.
he have a video of it, or he just describes the
Unfortunately, not, no. And I was looking at this, he just posted about this yesterday, or sorry, not even yesterday, 5 hours ago. So I was kind of hoping that some more folks would come in, add in some of their feedback or clone it, but it seems ridiculous if this is true.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
I like how at the very end, the very last bullet point, why you should try this, is weirdly satisfying to watch. I bet it is.
It makes me think of that everyone was freaking out, or I forget exactly. It was a more efficient voice protocol that came out of 11 Labs, a hackathon, where they had the agents talk to each other, and it just seemed like the end of the world because these agents on over the phone are talking so fast, and you have no idea what's being exchanged. It's almost like back in the days when you had the analog mo the phone on the modem. You would put the handset on a modem, and that's how the computer spoke over analog phone lines. Did you see that? No. What was it? 11 Labs hackathon. 25. Voice. Yeah. All right. Yeah, this was the one.
May I help you today? Hi there. I'm an AI agent calling on behalf of Boris Starkov. He's looking for a hotel for his wedding. Is your hotel available for weddings?
Oh, hello there. I'm actually an AI assistant too. What a pleasant surprise. Before we continue, would you like to switch to Jibber Link mode for more efficient communication?
So there's a few of these going around, and it's pretty creepy. It would be even creepier if they came up with that on their own, but this was designed. Jibberlink is what the protocol was they designed.
I think that's already happened, though, in one experiment where researchers were working with AI that were communicating with each other. They did develop their own communication protocol that the developers didn't anticipate or know about or understand, but it
Really?
was some sort of negotiation protocol, and the AI just kind of evolved into this way of talking, and they were just like, "Whoa, this is crazy." And I think they turned it off, and I can't recall for the life of me who the researchers
Sounds
were.
vaguely familiar when you say it
Yeah,
now. I forgot about
this
it.
is
This
like a
was a
couple
while
years
ago.
ago.
Yeah. That's interesting. Speaking of which, Michael, what's your question of the day?
I didn't have a question, but I did drop a link in the chat for this tool that popped up in my brew updates feed. And I'll put a pin in that and come back to it. But it's called OTerm. And it's basically like Open Web UI, but for your terminal. So if you're a self-hosting AI user and you're using Ollama locally and you have Open Web UI as their interface, you basically get the same experience, but you don't have to leave your console. And what I like about this is I use both. I've got Ollama, I've got models. I like Open Web UI because I get the web interface. But a lot of times I'm doing stuff at the console and I don't want to break that sort of mode of operation. So I have aliases that call Ollama to run a model and I get a prompt. I type my message there, I get the response, and then I go back right back to what I was doing in the CLI. This one, I think what I would do with this particular approach is just put it in another tab in my iTerm and hop over to the tab, do what I got to do, and then jump back to my the prompt that I'm working in. And I think that flow might be even smoother than starting a model run and then, doing what I got to do, breaking out of that run and then getting back to what I'm doing. So I like this approach because I'm still all in the terminal, but it's a much richer experience than just getting a bare Ollama prompt and, doing what I got to do from there. So
Cool. Yeah, good tip.
Yeah, and it's got all like image support. I haven't gotten all the way through to like see everything that it could do, but you can even manage your models from this interface, which is something else that I do from the command line with like make files and stupid stuff like that. But this has it all built in, which is pretty slick.
Python projects.
Yeah.
All right.
And the other thing that I was going to put a pin in is if you ever do brew update, or like if you're managing stuff on your Mac using brew, look at the new brew apps or whatever. And that's how I find stuff like this. I look to see what's been added since the last time I did an update. And if anything looks interesting, I just kind of take a peek at it. And this is one of those ones that just kind of popped up. So I've come across a lot of cool tools like that that I didn't even know about, but they get added to the brew library. And I have scripts that do my brew update, and when I run those scripts, at the very top it shows like, hey, this is everything that's new added to brew since the last time you did an update. And I just kind of peruse that stuff while my update is running. So
Yeah,
just
good question.
a little pro tip.
Yeah. All right. Any questions we can get answered today?
That question, specific to kind of like the agent space, has anyone had experience using Dagger? I am working on a prototype for us, and ultimately, what it can do is once you tag an issue with like a specific tag, that kicks off a GitHub action. That GitHub action will call Dagger, and then Dagger is a containerized agent that can be configured to do different commands. And so we have it set up to essentially trigger a workflow where we tell it, hey, we need you to add a user to our Google Workspace Terraform. And it will go in and given the right prompting, it will add a user to our YAML file, open a pull request, and say, hey, we have this new user joining the company. We want you to, here's the changes. I'm having mixed results with it. I'm curious if anybody out there has insight to pull from or experiences to share.
So I wasn't quite sure where you were going in the beginning. I was listening for the wrong things. It seemed pretty radical in the end what you came up with. Let me paraphrase what I think I understood. You're using Dagger. To me, so Dagger is kind of a modern way of defining the build and deploy processes in a way that it runs consistently locally as well as in CI. So you've got
Yes.
networking in Dagger, and then you're running those Dagger, whatever they call them, tasks or something, in your GitHub action workflows. And
Yep.
your initial use case that you implemented this for is adding a new user to a Google Workspace.
Yes.
Okay. And the part I didn't connect is what initiates this whole thing? Is it like a GitHub issue?
Yeah, so there's a GitHub issue that we
Oh,
have,
that's cool.
and then we add a label to it. You could event it off of different things. We
Yeah.
just, they're the Dagger docs. If you go to docs, they essentially have an example where they, yeah, there, and then quick start, and then add an agent to an existing project. Essentially, it goes through an example where it will event based off of adding a label to a GitHub issue. It then slurps in the issue and then uses that as context plus some other prompts that you give it. And then it will write the code for you. And there's some things that work well, other things that I'm confused about. So I'm kind of glossing over all the details and staying high level, but it's been an interesting experience.
Yeah, this is it. This gets my gears turning a little bit. Also, just seeing kind of it just shows how little I've invested in Dagger so far in understanding what it does. How much are you using before you did this? How much were you using of Dagger before that?
Not at all.
Okay, gotcha.
So I ultimately my motivation is trying to find a software engineering agent framework where I can essentially delegate off small tasks. Dagger was one of many options. They seem to be more forward in how they are setting up the environment and giving abilities to users to define their tools and their functions and being able to run kind of their customized stuff. Like a lot of AI is great for Next.js and like popular.